Probably the high rollers have a little bit more luxurious office, but it does look remarkably similar to the trading floor on the right-hand side. And that's typically where the money has been made. That's UBS, by the way. Trade floors for the larger banks have well over 1,000 people in them, and they're pretty impressive places. And the buzz on those, believe me, is far more of a buzz on that than there is on any of the gambling floors here in Las Vegas. The people who play, it's pretty much the same. They get just as excited, the money is just as big, and these people are looking at bonuses. They might be making $50 million for their business, but they've got big bonuses on the back of these. And as I'm sure you all know, the bonuses typically pay for airplanes and things like this. This isn't a bonus where you go out and you get a new extension on your house. This is where you go out and you buy a new street. So the guys make a lot of money on this sort of stuff. So we can look at some of the individual players. Now, I don't know this guy on the left, but I'm reliably informed by Google that he's somebody important in the gambling world. So I just searched for high rollers, and up he popped. The guy on the right, you might know his name. His name's Jerome. And if I bring up the next part, it'll probably ring a bell. He recently lost several billion dollars for a bank. So again, just goes to show the sorts of money that can be lost, billions of dollars. There's nine zeros after that. The traders wouldn't really be comfortable in Las Vegas. The problem with Las Vegas is that it's very predictable odds. If you play roulette, there are 37 little slots, and you can place your money on 36 of those 37, and 1/37th of the time, 2.7% of the time, you lose your money. You can play blackjack, you can play poker, you can play a lot of things, but unless you have an advantage over your opponents, you're going to lose money. Now, everybody cannot be awestruck by the size of this building. It's easy to get lost getting here. It's easy to get lost going anywhere. Even finding your way to the restrooms is quite a job. Where do you think the money comes from to build these places? This comes out of the money that all the people have lost that have played here. So the odds are that you will lose, no matter how much you play here. And there's no doubt somebody's going to shoot me for saying this, but I think it's fairly obvious you will lose if you play lots of money here. You might gain on the small turns, but you'll lose. In the banking world, this isn't the case. The banks are big, yes, they're not as big as this. And they have money, yes, because people invest, they put their money into the banks. But you can win and you can lose, and you can do that on the long term or the short term. So the money is there, the opportunities are there. So it's a very, very interesting place to play. Another interesting fact is you can actually make money on share prices and currencies going down, which is something you can't do here. So the clever traders recently, some of the banks, for example, Lehman Brothers, there was a rumor that Lehman Brothers was going to disappear. People can make billions of dollars just on a rumor in one day, not personally, but for the bank, just by betting on the fact that there will be a 30% loss on the share price of Lehman Brothers. So again, there's a lot of energy and that goes into this. Another thing that's interesting is that even if you were, let's say, to take the money from here and set up a trading center here in Las Vegas, there's one thing that prohibits us from doing that, and that's a very universal constant, which is sort of quite interesting. So imagine that you set up, you've got a lot of interesting, clever people here in this audience and generally in this area. Now, if we all to get together and we come up with the most incredibly fast, high-performing trading engine that you could possibly imagine, and we decide to set it up here in Las Vegas because the weather's pretty nice and there's a lot of good things to do in the spare time, and you go to the IT provider and you get a very fast Ethernet and or fiber optic cable put in all the way across to the exchanges in New York and Chicago. The problem is you'll find that once you've installed that is that you'll have an inexplicable, or quite easily explicable if you understand the laws of physics, 24 millisecond delay. That's the absolute best time. This delay is caused quite simply by the speed of light. It takes this light 24 milliseconds to do the round trip between here and New York. So if a price is quoted on the New York Stock Exchange, you decide to trade on that, and you have got the absolute state-of-the-art piece of kit working on the very best processors, and you return that in 1 millisecond, for example, you've still got another 12 milliseconds to get back to New York to say, yes, I want to buy, or yes, I want to sell that. So this is the reason that we find a lot of banks, large investment houses, and and exchanges based around small areas. So they're all based around, they're not actually in the center of New York. The main centers are actually built just outside New York in New Jersey. And so that's where all the stock exchanges are, but that's also where all the trading houses are, and they build them physically right next to them. And the same is true in Chicago. Chicago Mercantile Exchange has a secret location. Nobody's supposed to know where it is. There's a bunch of people that do know where it is. And clever hedge funds put snoopers on all of the networks all around Chicago for months to try and work out the position and location of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. They found it, and they built their hubs on the next floor above the exchange, because the speed of light time to get downstairs is significantly better than building it in the suburbs somewhere else in Chicago. Those milliseconds, again, remember, 1 millisecond up to $100 million difference per year. So that justifies and pays for all of the efforts to find this. So this is a very common situation. The hedge funds will actually put all of their hardware physically right next to the exchanges. They will, however, control these exchanges, and they'll put all their clever mathematics written, I should add, in all sorts of different languages, rarely in Java, because, as I'll explain shortly, it's not quite quick enough in this case, but frequently in Python, in all sorts of other sort of similar languages that are compiled down to assembly. They can actually do these from any remote location. So you'll find the hedge funds are actually physically dotted around all over the world. Can be in the Caribbean. One of the largest is in Los Angeles, in Beverly Hills. And they literally send these across to New York, to Chicago, to London, to Tokyo, etc. And they're executed there on the scene. So why aren't these necessarily Java? Well, again, 20,000, 100,000 of these messages coming in a second. And your absolute top priority is to make the deal. You're basically paid not only your salary, but your bonus and everything else for this hedge fund. The entire existence of this hedge fund is based around making money. It's there for no other reason than to trade. Now, if you can shave, as we said many times, a millisecond or even fractions of a millisecond off the time, then it makes significantly larger amounts of money for the hedge funds. And if you've got to wait for a Java virtual machine, you've got to wait for a JIT compiler, you've got to wait for a garbage collector or something to kick in. Now, we know that the garbage collector these days, they can be tuned down to suns and BA and IBM are now talking sort of microsecond garbage collection by running separate threads, et cetera, and doing all sorts of clever things. Azul is another option here where they've got the Java collection collected externally to the main threads that you're using. The problem is that these work currently on specialized hardware. So Sun, although they keep promising it's going to work in Linux, their claim is that Linux is not real-time, or there's not a real-time Linux around yet, and they still only work in Solaris. Now, we don't want to go out deploying loads of Solaris boxes. We want the liberty to deploy anything. So the hedge funds are typically putting out just boxes of Dell machines with no cases around them. They literally just take the card out of the box, and they'll put racks of these, and they're taped up by Velcro. And they'll put 200 of these in, and they'll network them up, and this is typically what we're using. And they run Linux on them. We strip everything, all of the processes out of Linux, all of the daemon processes, and it's stripped right the way down to its bare minimum. And this is what we run. The problem is that we can't afford some of the latencies of the garbage collector and other things, because if a garbage collector kicks in for even 1 millisecond, it can actually interfere with the trading. And typically, the garbage collector will kick in at that worst moment when you've got the highest volumes going through. Almost by definition, if you've got high volumes, you've got lots of objects being created. And just at that particular time, that's when the garbage collector comes in and destroys all of your work. So on the very, very bleeding edge technologies, it's sad to say that Java is still not quite there. The technology is available, and it will be available on generalized hardware, and I hope in the next few years. But I've come across many situations where I've been asked to design these systems, to work on these systems, and it's being a Java evangelist, obviously, I would love it to be Java, but I still can't justify that to make this sort of money. When you've got a hedge fund owning several tens of billions of dollars, and they're making this sort of money, you've really got to pick the right job. So right on the very bleeding edge, it's not quite there yet. So the garbage collector is really the biggest issue. The reliability, predictability of the performance is another issue. You want something to be absolutely real-time. If you want something to be picked up or sent at a very precise amount of time. This is something we still don't get out of Java. Now, if you have a guy from here, from Sun, who's working on the Sun real time, he'll tell you that this is all perfectly doable now, as long as you buy a Sun Solaris box. The same will be true from the IBM guys. So it's something that's really got a little bit of work to go so far. So where is Java best at? Coming down from the bleeding edge, and remembering that the bleeding edge is really probably the top 5-10% at the very most. The vast majority of investment banking code, I'd say probably 80-85% is written in Java. So this is nice, this is very comforting. Areas where it's very good, it's absolutely superb for distributed technologies. So if you've got extremely large volumes, not necessarily volumes coming through per second, but very large areas where typically you would put them through to disk, we can now distribute these around memory. Java being a dynamic language that can have not only data but also methods, we can actually attach methods and data to a Java object, essentially by the class that defines it, and we can actually distribute these around the systems. This makes it extremely powerful. And we see a lot of vendors coming out of this sort of space that are going from strength to strength. Coherence was recently acquired, in fact, last year by Oracle, and it was actually literally a year ago, almost today, because the acquisition went through during the server-side symposium last year, and it was actually announced on the very last day by Cameron Purdy, who was the founder of Tangersoll. So that is acquisition is evidence of the fact that there is a market in this place. Gigaspace is going, again, getting bigger and bigger. It's going from a few years ago where they had 5 or 10 customers to, and they're counting their customers in hundreds now. So it's, again, you see a huge move in this place. Gemfire is still, as part of Gemstone, still very strong, still seeing this as a major player. Essentially what these are high-performance computing vendors that allow you to distribute methods or tasks across multiple machines. And some of them distribute simply the data, and the fact that the data is distributed means it can be distributed to different processors, which of course can execute them on in different machines and different environments. And this is becoming the main strength. This is distinct from an application server, where you have to have a very precise definition of what the application server is, how it runs, and what its actual constraints are. You're very constrained in a typical J2E application server by what you can use programmatically. You're constrained by the deployment topology. If you want to expand a J2E application hub, you need to actually take it down, stop it, very typically. Again, BA will tell you differently, but in practice, for the vast majority of people that are running these sort of things, you need to take it down, reconfigure it, set up new machines, recluster it, redefine the clusters, and then fire it up again. And this doesn't give us the dynamic scalability we need in the banking world, or in fact in many other places. So I think it's very fair to say, again, going back to numerous other server-side symposiums and things over the last few years, this place used to be absolutely obsessed with EJBs, J2EE, and this. And we now see this pretty much dying off. It's very much more Spring. We see a lot of the lightweight open source containers, the mules, the service mixes, et cetera. And these companies like Gigaspaces and Coherence from Oracle now starting to take precedence. So I see a firm movement from application servers in towards what we typically known in the past as grid technologies. Another advantage is these scale down as well as up. So as an application server, you could actually run on your laptop, in theory, if you had enough resources. The grid actually runs a lot more efficiently on a laptop than an application server would, because it actually uses less resources. It's designed to be more efficient. So you can actually run these applications on your laptop and then scale up to typically a large bank, which would run across several thousand CPUs. And so again, it makes it very easy to copy. Another advantage is you can upload these to EC2. It's much easier to upload to EC2. Anybody here use EC2? Anybody not know what EC2 is? Go on, be brave. Yeah, a few hands. Thank you. EC2 is the most wonderful thing released by Amazon. It's part of their web services. Now, any individual can sign up for this. Takes about 10 minutes. You sign up on Amazon. You use the same thing as you do for logging, for buying books. You sign up for web services. And basically, they've made, I've no idea how many they've got, they've made literally thousands and thousands, or probably tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of servers available for you to use, and you pay by the hour, by the CPU, and it's in cents. So effectively, you can take your application, you can lease one of these CPUs, it's all virtualized, and you can upload all your applications. And so we're seeing a lot of businesses starting to do this. We're even seeing banks starting to offload perhaps future scalability problems onto something like EC2, which you basically pay for it as and when you need it. So it's a very good scalability. And so for those of you that haven't discovered, I'd really highly recommend it. EC2 is the, what it stands for, Elastic something compute center. Elastic Computing Cloud. Thank you very much. Elastic Computing Cloud. So acronyms always win out on this one. So Elastic Computing Cloud. There's another thing called S3, which gives you essentially as much disk space as you want to use, and you can actually now cleverly mount the S3 stuff on EC2, and it's absolutely brilliant. This will change the face of computing that we see today. This isn't one of these sort of like EJB3 is going to change things. This will change things. This will change computing as we know it. So EC2 is one of the first things that came out that will be doing this for you. So keep an eye on that, and I strongly recommend that you can have a poke around on that. So Java's ideal place is where the latency is typically around, it's moving up, or it's moving down, I should say, so 8, 9, 10 milliseconds sort of area. Volumes are typically massive. We can still handle quite happily tens of thousands a second. If we've got tens of thousands of a second and we don't need the latency, then we're in a perfect world for Java. The messages are typically highly complex, and this is where we need to use some clever things like Java binding. A derivative is one of the sort of newfangled trading instruments that people use since the sort of early, mid-90s. And so essentially what they do is they offset risk. So you've got a high risk thing on one side, and you offset that against something lower risk, and the swapping of these two is called a derivative. Now, a derivative itself is incredibly complex, and the definitions of the derivatives are complex. The problem is that you've got to, when you trade this with someone else, just like you go through your Visa bill, you've got to be able to justify, or certainly to match the Visa bills that you, or receipts that you have in your pockets with what Visa send you. So this is called matching and reconciliation. And the matching and reconciliation of one derivative against the derivative that your opposing bank or broker has done is actually incredibly complex. A typical derivative would represent something sort of upwards of 15K in XML. So there's a lot of structure to it. The overall structure defining that can be as many as sort of 4,000 different elements that's defined in a thing called FPML. And it's if you're into schemas, then look at fpml.org. It's an extremely well-designed schema that's very worthwhile looking at. The problem is, however, that representing this incredibly complex XML in financial services instruments where you're in financial services situations where you're pushing these around is incredibly complex. The companies that came from the 90s, the late 80s, early 90s, are hard pushed to match, for example, 50 a minute. They're in the sort of one or two a second, if they're lucky. The requirements of these are in the hundreds or even thousands per second. So there's a huge gap between what could be done using databases and what can now be done using today's technologies in memory. So we're seeing a very strong move away from databases into in-memory databases. So a derivative matching engine is something which it's an area which I'm particularly fond of in terms of a good opportunity to use this sort of technology. There's no way that you can, it would take several seconds even on a decent server to actually persist this 4,000 element XML hierarchical structure into a relational database using something like Hibernate or Ibotters. It's just, I've seen it done, and it's normally done to prove why you wouldn't do it. It's done as an exercise. If somebody's arguing, saying, but we've always done it in databases, well, you know, times change. So the sole reason that I've actually seen this done is purely to prove the case that it's not viable. The other problem is that the XML that represents this, that goes into the database, changes roughly every few weeks, or even at worst every 2 months. at best every 2 months. So not only have you do the mapping once, but you've got to constantly keep up to date with this. Now, if we can take that XML and we can put it into a Java object and we can put the object into memory and we can access that object, we can do everything we need to do that we could have done with a database. SQL selects, SQL goes out of the window, of course. It's not a particularly good language for this. It's great for relational databases, but it's not good for hierarchical. So we can now start to extract information out using some of the APIs that Gigaspaces and Tangosol, et cetera, give us to extract the information out. And we can actually now use this as an in-memory database. The performance that you get out of this is orders, three, sometimes four orders of magnitude faster than a database. I've seen brute force searches through 100,000 records actually go quicker than a single SQL search on an index field in a database, purely because the time it takes to actually do all the joins across all of the different tables. So this is the only way we can move forward. And there are banks, most of the large banks are investing tens of millions of dollars into this sort of technology to come away from databases into in-memory and distributed memory caches. And this, again, is one of the reasons that these companies I mentioned before are actually starting to become very widely used and well-funded. Now, if you've got everything in memory, essentially you can match the left side and right side. One of the technologies I've used, well, in fact, I've used all of these, Gigaspaces, Tangosol, and Gemstone. This is an example of a derivative matching engine written using Gigaspaces. It's a Java-based matching engine. There are a number of other choices that we could have used. It could have been implemented equally in any one of the other technologies. Essentially, Javaspace is a cloud architecture. So it's the ability to put an object into a space and then to retrieve it based on various criteria afterwards. It's not matched on data, it's matched on a method that it exposed. It's matched on functional features, if you like. So essentially what we do, imagine this being your Visa bills, we write the two sides of the trade into a space. So first of all, we pick up the object, the XML, we parse it into a Java object. We're using Java binding technology, and we place both sides into the grid, into the Java space in this particular case. There's a bit of code there just to show you literally how easy it is. We use a URL, we go off and find the particular space that we're looking for. Now, the clustering and resilience is built in to the configuration of the space. Now, like Tangosol, like Gigaspaces, et cetera, this is dynamically scalable. This is immensely important. What this means is that we can just, if we need more power, we can just go in and plug in new servers, fire them up, and they instantly start to participate in this grid. This is incredibly important because when you need more power, that is the last time you just cannot take the system down. So when you need more power, that's the time when you really have to have dynamic scalability. So we write these both into the space, and very simply, we have a little thread that sits and runs on one of the multiple machines that basically goes off, looks for matched pairs, and says, right, I'll randomly pick out one of these, usually the most recent one, or certainly the one that's sitting up that's been in there the longest, and I'll go and look for its matched pair. If it can't find the matched pair, it'll throw it back again because perhaps the matched pair hasn't arrived. It'll go off, go and find the next one, try and match it. When it matches it, very simply, it sends it off to the output. And the output is simply a sort. We have a source on the input, a sync on the output, MQ series, TIBCO RV, something like that, input and output. Now, to get the scalability out of this is actually quite simple. The little purple bit here that you see, we simply make lots and lots of these. So this is the bit when we need the scalability. We just add new machines. We fire up new worker threads on these. This is called a master worker pattern. We fire up new workers, and essentially, the workers themselves not only provide the processing, but they also provide memory as well to participate in the space. So typically, when the objects are put into the space, as you see here, we've got the two different parts going into the space, they could be written onto the machine that's actually writing them as a local object, or they could actually be serialized and placed onto one of the machines which is actually running one of the processes. So as we add more machines, we both add capability and we add performance as well. So again, it's a beautifully scalable, linearly scalable model. And I've got some figures to demonstrate the scalability out of these. So here's another example, things we're having. SWIFT is what every single bank on the planet uses to send money from one bank to another, with a few exceptions internally inside countries. Some of the countries have their own proprietary networks and can use the proprietary network to transfer money from an internal or a local bank. But to send money from one country to another, and typically even inside the countries, they'll use the SWIFT network. The SWIFT network's been around for 30-odd years, and in those 30 years, it's had 99.986% reliability. They have never once lost a single message. When you see the sorts of volumes that go through that, that's pretty amazing. The other thing is that when you place a message on the SWIFT network, they guarantee the value of the message. So if you place $1 billion message saying, pay this company $1 billion, if that message is lost, well, it's not $1 billion that is lost, obviously, because the money never left the original bank, but it's the interest of $1 billion over one night. Now, in most currencies, sort of somewhere between 3 and 6% interest, or 2 to 6% interest, that's still a lot of money. It's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they will pay that back if it's lost. But so far, they've never lost a message, and certainly the incentive of doing that is fairly obvious. But when somebody says reliable messaging, that's reliable messaging. You have to pay back the value of the message that you've lost if you lose it. The messages are horrendously complex. It's been around for 30 years. They've been using the same messages for 30 years. XML didn't exist in those days, and so they're migrating slowly to XML. Given the fact there are 80,000-odd banks running this, it's not something that you change overnight. You can't simply go from SWIFT being used for the last 30 years to SWIFT XML. So this is a process that will take roughly probably about 10 years to complete. So the big change is moving from MT, message type, to MX, which is the message XML, and this is one of the tasks that every single bank will have to go through eventually. Some of the banks have started this early, and the sort of volumes that we're going through here are, again, pretty large. Now, this diagram using the famous Gregorgrams from Gregor Hope demonstrates the workflow. So essentially, the message comes in on an MQ series queue. It's an MT format. We parse it into a router, and then from that point, we can actually process the message to do a transformation from MT format to MX format. The problem is we need this to be scalable. So we need high-performance transformations. Now, the way to do the transformations, we can't use XSLT because the originating side is not XML. You can do XSLT to produce pretty much anything, but you can't actually start on something unless it's generally XML. So what we do, we use Java binding technology to bind the incoming object and the outgoing object, and we can use getters and setters to provide the transformation between incoming and outgoing. Now, because you've got a model for the input, you've got a transformation built using getters and setters for the transformation, and you've got a model for the output, essentially you've got three jars. Those three jars can be deployed into a grid, and this is what gives us the scalability. So essentially, Java binding technology, there's a number that you can use, GBEX, Castor, JaxB. The company that I founded is called C24. That was the basis of what we used to do. We used to take, we started with JaxB and Castor. They didn't work for some of the more complex financial services XML. So we improved these, and we got them to work with not only XML, but also comma delimited file formats, SWIFT, and various other technologies. And this gave us the ability to deploy these into grid. And this was what's now been acquired by Iona. So essentially, on the left-hand side, you have the nasty incoming SWIFT format. You have a transformation, which is basically graphically represents, this is a snippet, probably less than 1% of the actual entire transformation that's behind this. So it's a small part of it. It's one of the methods. So incoming, nasty format on the left-hand side, XML format on the right-hand side. But the output of this is not interpreted, it's Java. And because it's a simple POJO, the POJO can be deployed into a space, into Tangasol, into gigaspaces, et cetera, and can be deployed and executed at incredibly high volumes. So as the flow comes in, the scaling this system up, we can use basically a small standalone ESB, something again like Mule or Fuse service mix, to host this. But as we want to scale up, what we use is a Spring container. The Spring container basically abstracts the container that we're using behind that, and this is where we can start to introduce, for example, something like GigaSpaces to sit behind the container to allow us to expand the performance on this. So the sort of scaling, the reasons we get the scale out of this, so in comes the message into the Mule adapter, and we place the message as a Java object into the Java space. We have a little worker. ADS is the Artix Data Services, is what Iona renamed the C24 product. Basically picks up the Swift message, transforms it, and places the result back as a XML message. Now, if we want to scale this out, this basically goes off and is sent back out, again using Mule, and that's nice and simple. That works on a laptop. So we want to scale this up a little bit, we can put another one of these in, and it can pick up more Swift messages. Because there are more Swift messages, not only does it add, again, CPU, but it also adds memory to this as well. We can scale that up further by introducing lots more workers. Again, add the workers, you add both the CPU capability, but you also add memory. So again, you're scaling up in every possible way. We did this recently on an Azul box. Azul is a large box with a dedicated CPU inside, which has, if you like, think of it as hardware garbage collection. And we ran this through. As you can see, the performance figures on the left-hand side, the number of threads that were used on the bottom. So this was 192 core box. Now, bear in mind that there are a number of threads that are actually used to manage this. So the scalability, as you can imagine, I would have done it up to 192 threads if it was perfectly linear. It wasn't, so I cut the graph off. I sort of cheated. But as you can see, for this part, we go up to 130-odd threads, 135 threads. It is beautifully linear. And I have to say, we did this in front of a live audience at the Java User Group in New York last autumn, and we did this on Azul's 768 CPU box, and we managed to achieve, again, linear scalability up to 130,000 transformations per second, which I think actually the largest user of Swift is Citigroup. They put 1.9 million messages through in a day. We could have actually done the entire day's worth of processing in 15 seconds. So I think it's sort of nonsensical, but it's quite an impressive figure when it comes to the sort of performance that we get out of this. So this is the sort of scalability that we're now seeing and we're now using, and this is what the banks are now using for the for their technologies. I've got a couple of sort of statements. I think I've given you some sort of indication of the sort of way perhaps databases are going, the way that certainly J2E is moving towards grid. Grid's becoming more sort of the de facto standard. So I've separated this into two sections. So some of the findings that we've certainly got. Java real-time is definitely, there's a huge need for it. It's something which is holding Java back. It's one of the main reasons that we still see C and C++ in a lot of these trading engines and the front office. The database is no longer the center of the world. If you can imagine, any of you that are older enough to remember back to the mid-90s, the DBA used to be the most powerful person in the entire organization, who outstripped the head of HR, the CEO, et cetera. The DBA, database administrator, could do anything. They could basically, you know, find out your salaries, change whatever it was that you needed to do. But all of the integration used to be around the database. The database was the center of the enterprise world. This is no longer the case. It's moved into messaging now. So messaging is now the center of the world. The center of the world is based around the messaging formats that are interchanged between the enterprises. The database now is just another application. And really, it should be abstracted to the stage where it is simply something, you give it some data, and it should store it. That is the only job of a database. And I'm very against, certainly when I'm working in architecture, using any of the proprietary features of any database, whether that be Oracle, Sybase, Berkeley DB, MySQL, PostgreSQL, etc. For me, a database is, here's a file, store it. And I'd like to be able to retrieve it with this index. But you can do that with memory, you can do it with the database. It is a commodity, and it should remain as a commodity. And the more you treat it as a commodity, the better you'll be able to scale, and the better you'll be able to get these sort of performance figures. There are still places where relational databases will still be very useful, the same as COBOL is still useful today in some places. But I'm not suggesting it will disappear or go away. They have their uses, but it's ceasing to be the center of the world. It's difficult these days to imagine anybody actually making any money out of ESBs or J2EE because it's becoming so open source. The vast majority of, certainly the banks now, are using the open source versions. So the open source versions that have been used, certainly there is money being made by the support behind these, but J2EE and certainly the ESB stuff behind that, there's money to be made from the support, but there's very little money to be made from product. It's generally commoditized in this area. So we're seeing a general movement from applications being hosted by an application server into applications being hosted by a grid or virtualized server. And this is definitely a trend that's been demonstrated over the last few years. Spring has sort of become pretty much de facto standard for most developments. My question is basically, all the Spring guys will be here this year. They were here last year, here the year before. Get to the stage where you wonder whether what's going to be after Spring. Where will Spring move to? Because it's been around long enough now that it's actually become... I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with it. There are a few things, but it's been around long enough that perhaps we're waiting for next technology. Grid's definitely mainstream now. It's not something which is just for the likes of the large banks. You can actually build quite viable, small applications on laptops and small servers using grid technology. You don't need the scalability out of it, but it's a beautifully simple way to actually write applications today and have them hosted by something that's not going to eat up your entire resources, like a Microsoft operating system, just to do the most basic thing. An application server eats up huge amounts of resource just to do Hello World, and Microsoft eats up most of your resources and kills them as well, just to print up something Hello World. So it's a very, very small amount of resource that's used up. So I think grid is, certainly these technologies are very, very viable as application hosts. And I think you should seriously consider using some of these as application servers. OSGI is an interesting technology. There's will be quite a bit on OSGI this week. I do wonder how that's going to change the business world, because it is still very much a sort of developer's side of things. There's going to be some huge changes with OSGI sort of becoming fairly mainstream, but I just wonder whether that's actually going to make any changes. We're going to see that outside of the business world. One of the other things, virtualization. I mentioned EC2 before. EC2 is a perfect example of virtualization, but virtualization is also becoming sort of fairly mainstream. Virtually everything in a bank is now virtualized. Banks like to go off and buy very large numbers of machines. They'll run typically Linux on these boxes, and they'll virtualize everything inside them to get best use out of them. There's obviously a competition between the Java virtual machine and the virtual machine which has been provided by the operating system. Most of the vendors are very much aware of this. BEA, Sun, IBM, etc. are working on this, and obviously if you've got an operating system which has then got another virtualization layer, which has got yet another operating system running inside that, which has then got a Java virtual machine, which has finally got your application running inside it, there's an awful lot of layers to get through to get anywhere. And so this is obviously somewhere where we can start to see these layers disappear and start to be eaten up. And again, I think that's another area that's going to be very interesting over the next few years. So what will change between now and next year? I certainly think you'll see an awful lot more applications. I would actually put money on the fact that you'll see several people standing up here next year talking about applications running on EC2. I think that's going to be probably the biggest change that we see at the moment. With that, I've left you with a few questions, and I've hopefully given you a few ideas or certainly some plans that we're seeing as trends in the banking world. We've got 4 minutes, gone down to 3 minutes left. So anybody have any questions at all? Yes. There's a microphone, just Eugene's getting his daily exercise. Good man.
The linear scalability graph you showed, was that with Coherence or GigaSpaces?
That was it was actually GigaSpaces running inside on an Azure box. And some of the extra threads, there were a number of threads that were being used for management. It was linearly scalable, and it peaked off. I cheat, so I chopped the end off. Any vendor would do that. In fact, it's not something I'm selling. It's just I want to prove the linear scalability. It's impressive there. There's one down here after that. Yes?
Just curious if you've looked at Terracotta and used that. It's a different way to skin the cat than GigaSpaces, but it's kind of a similar idea of a cache.
Terracotta is something which appeared on our plates about 3 years ago when I was at JP Morgan Chase. It's something which I see up and coming. I actually have I met up with Addy today, and I've got a meeting set up with him next week to learn the ins and outs of Terracotta. Terracotta is definitely one of the players in this space. It's not quite as mainstream as some of the others, but that doesn't mean that it won't be in the coming years. This space is rich enough for plenty of players. This is, we've seen operating systems and J2E vendors and JMS vendors and everything else. There's plenty of room in this. So Terracotta is not something I know inside out, but I certainly hope by next week I should know an awful lot more about it.
With you having done the test on a box with just a whole lot of CPUs and basically moving all that data across probably a very fast bus, it looks like, you know, it performs well. Have you seen issues using gigabit Ethernet or other commodity technologies in large grids, with that becoming the bottleneck, or do you see it being able to overcome that?
There was one of the huge problems. I presume you all heard the question, so I won't repeat it. The problems with the gigabit Ethernet, yes, there was a classic problem with when we go back to the days when blades were all of the rage. People coming out with these blade servers where you buy a rack, a 3U rack is about that deep, and inside would be slots of blades, and each blade would have, say, 2 to 4 CPUs. And essentially, you could get 16 of them in one rack, so you get 16, 32, 48, 64, etc. So you get an awful lot of CPUs in a box. And on the backplane of these was a sort of gigabit Ethernet or 10 gigabit Ethernet. This is before InfiniBand, that sort of thing. And yes, we had absolute massive problems getting the bandwidth that we needed. This is one of the main reasons that some of these blade servers actually failed in production. We could not use them because the bandwidth they provided on the back planes of these boxes was not sufficient to actually transport the data that went across. Now, things like InfiniBand, iSCSI, et cetera, things are changing. So there are problems. It's something you've got to look at in performance with getting stuff across the network. And this is a distinct advantage of something like Azure, for example, that has 768 CPUs stuck in one box with 500 gigabytes of RAM. It's pretty impressive, and there's no network to hit. You can do some pretty amazing things on it. We had to VPN into their box when we did it in New York because it's a little bit too heavy to sort of take on a flight. But there is a distinct advantage of being able to use something like EC2 or a network where you can literally scale up as well. So there have been problems in that area. Any more questions at all?
You talk about latency, but when you talk about EC2, isn't there the latency of serializing and deserializing the XML when you're calling those services?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this, again, is if you're using EC2, you're not going to be using it for a low latency system because, A, you've got to get your stuff up onto EC2. EC2 is something that for the moment and certainly for the short to medium term is going to be non-low latency. It's something that provides good server throughput, but the latency to get there and back. As with any distributed system, you take a serious hit when you actually hit the network. And one of the graphs I've got typically is if you can keep everything inside the same machine with the CPUs inside the same box, don't hit the network, you'll get much, much better performance. It's two or three times better performance than hitting the network. Problem is you can't scale past the edge of the box. You have to take that hit. It's like hitting a small cliff. You take a step down, but once you've done that, you can scale up from that point. Serialization is a big issue. One of the biggest things that we put in my previous company was to actually do customized serialization, where we, depending on the type of the object, depending on the hierarchy and the structure of the object, we could generate the serialization for the read and write objects. That increased serialization by up to six times, which meant that XML would come in, we'd parse it into an object, and then we'd use customized serialization to avoid the hit of the reflection on the object to actually serialize it across to another machine. And from that point onwards, it's up to optimization to limit the amount of serialization you do. But if you want scalability, you're going to have to serialize it at some point. And XML is definitely not the sort of thing you want to be sending over the wire, if possible, which is one reason why XML is used, but it's not as commonplace, and certainly why web services you won't see inside investment banks for some years to come yet, because it's just too many little brackets and things. Is that it, Eugene?
One more question, anybody? Going once, going twice. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'd like to thank everybody. Thank you very much.